Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the movie review podcast, where sometimes things explode. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic. The way you introduced it, sometimes things explode, makes it sound like it's going to be really contentious.
Mm.
It's going to be hotly debated films on the podcast, which we do sometimes.
Maybe, but I just meant that, like, literally, just things around my apartment are a little unstable right now.
All right, just keep the nitroglycerin steady.
Yeah. Podcasts of fear.
But that's not our hook. We're not the contentious podcast.
No,
we're not
really.
Bickersome critics.
No, I don't think sometimes more than others, but
we get on each other's faces a lot.
Yeah, you're a big jerk with your jerk face.
So I can't help it if I have better taste than you.
Neither can I. This week on Critically Acclaimed, we got some catching up to do. Last week we didn't have a Critically Acclaimed episode because there actually wasn't much out.
Like, we'd only seen, like, a film and a half each, and
just barely seemed, like, worth putting an episode together at that point. We'll wait other stuff to catch up on. So we decided we'd save it, and now we have a big old double-decker episode for you, because here's what we're reviewing this week on Critically Acclaimed. Asghar Farhadi's A Hero. New York Ninja. Home Team. The Ice Age Adventures of Buck Wild. A Taste of Hunger, The Fallout, and The House.
You know, those films aren't, like, The Fallout is kind of a downbeat and very emotional movie.
Yeah.
It doesn't really warrant the sort of Mr. Movie Phone introduction you gave it there.
All movies warrant a Mr. Movie Phone introduction. That's the one thing they all have in common.
I do remember when, you know, Movie Phone was a thing that we did.
Yeah.
Call your area code 777-FILM, and they would talk it through. A little recording would tell you the titles of all of the local movies, depending on which letters you entered on the keypad.
I honestly wonder what the last movie I checked on Movie Phone was. It might have been, if I'm gonna guess, might have been Cold Mountain.
Oh, yeah. Cold Mountain.
Yeah.
You have selected Cold Mountain. Rated R. Yeah. I do recall an instance where my girlfriend at the time, now my wife, we wanted to see a movie. And we didn't have smartphones. We just had the flip phones. So we called Movie Phone. And it wasn't quite working with the little keypads. And it was like, you have selected, enter your zip code. It just wasn't reading.
Yeah.
And out of frustration, my wife, like, sort of just mashed her knuckles into the keypad. Like, why didn't you work? You know, kind of comically. And after that, it said, you have selected Norbit. And it's like, no, we definitely didn't. We didn't want to see Norbit.
You have purchased 38 tickets to Norbit.
No, fuck. I hope you're on your way because it starts in 5 minutes. No refunds. But that's the way you got your tickets back in the day.
Good times. Anyway, we got
But let's review some. Yeah. Let's review these movies.
Let's talk about what's happening right now, shall we?
Sure.
Let's actually, be in the here and now.
Although Movie Phone is still a thing. There's a website, moviephone.com. Yeah. So if you wonder why it's called Movie Phone,
yes,
that's why. It used to be a phone.
What do you want to start with, Whitney?
Let's talk about New York Ninja, because this is a fascinating thing.
This is one of the most interesting films that's, like, coming out this month, especially considering it should have come out in 1984.
Well, I'm not sure if it should have come out. It was shot in 1984. The deal with New York Ninja is Vinegar Syndrome, the video releasing company, I think they literally found these in a dumpster.
They were in a warehouse. They have a warehouse full of stuff. Vinegar Syndrome is a DVD and Blu-ray distribution company. Really, really great one. And the raison d'etre is to clean up, like, really just spruce up, make them look nice. Trash.
A lot of sleazy movies. A lot of just straight up pornography.
Some of it is actually, like, interesting artistically. Some of it is not. Sometimes they get their hands on low budget horror movies that nobody's given a second glance to in decades. But because Vinegar Syndrome put it out nice, we give it the time of day and we realize, oh, actually that's pretty good. They've got mostly have impeccable taste in crap. Like, they're not quite the criterion of crap, but they're pretty close. They're the closest we got.
Yeah. you can find a lot of Vinegar Syndrome movies on the Night Flight channel. Mm-hmm. Get Night Flight Plus. They have their own sort of devoted section to Vinegar Syndrome.
Yeah.
The name Vinegar Syndrome comes from what happens to film when it degrades.
Yeah.
When you have a 35mm acetate print around for too long, it starts to rot after a while.
Yeah, just and, the chemicals to start to go
and
brutal.
When film starts to rot and shrink, it... something about the enzymes and the chemicals in the dye and in the actual cellulose gives off this very powerful odor that smells a lot like vinegar. So when you open up a film can, you get this, you're hit with this huge, like it smells like a fish and chip shop. So they call it Vinegar Syndrome.
Yeah.
Vinegar Syndrome, the video company, found a bunch of reels for a film with no sound.
There was supposed to be sound, but the sound was gone.
The sound was gone, and... they went through this movie and they found it was shot in New York in 1984 by a established kung fu star.
John Liu.
John Liu. And you look up John Liu's career and he did a lot of kung fu movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this was part of like a series that he was going to do, these ninja movies.
Ninjas were incredibly popular in America in the 1980s. So throw a ninja in something, you were going to make some money.
He made this movie, and there was no sound, and from what I understand, they only had, like, a partial script. It wasn't, like, an actual screenplay for this movie. And Vinegar Syndrome, using lip reading...
sometimes.
sometimes. And also, and the script, were able to sort of piece together what this film would have looked like had it had sound.
Yeah. So they cleaned it up, they edited it together,
it together as best as they could figure out, and they hired a lot of known, like, B-movie luminaries to dub the voices of the characters on screen.
So, for example, the protagonist of the film, played by director John Liu, is now being voiced by Don the Dragon Wilson. No small get, basically. You've got a genre luminary Linnea Quigley playing one of the detectives. You've got the inimitable Michael Berryman.
He's great.
From The Hills Have Eyes and Weird Science. Honestly, doing what sounds like an impeccable Jeffrey Combs impersonation. Like, I thought it was Jeffrey Combs, actually, initially, when they started.
And I'm used to Michael Michael Berryman has this wonderful kind of... it's like sinister voice he puts on in a lot of his roles. It had to be done, Lieutenant. Yeah. And it was kind of weird to hear him do this other impersonation, but he plays the villain of the piece.
Yeah, quick correction. Linnea Quigley doesn't play the detective. Cynthia Rothrock. Martial arts star extraordinaire Cynthia Rothrock plays the detective. Linnea Quigley plays a reporter who's reporting on all the ninja goings on. And Ginger Lynn plays John Liu's wife, who dies very quickly into the movie and gives him a reason to don ninja garb and roller skate around New York City, chopping people up with swords.
This is an odd animal because they weren't going for authenticity. It seems like they were trying to construct a cult phenomenon, Vinegar Syndrome, along the lines of something like Samurai Cop. If you know Samurai Cop, it was directed by Amir Shervan is the director's name, and this completely bizarre zero-budget film with Robert Zadar about a cop who's a samurai. Well, he has a samurai sword in one scene.
Yeah.
That he's a samurai has almost nothing to do with the movie.
It's just a good title. Yeah.
Samurai Cop. The Amir Shervan trilogy is wonderful. Hollywood Cop, Samurai Cop, and Killing American Style. And these are sort of underground films that get a little bit of a toehold, and they start becoming sort of big on the midnight circuit.
Yeah.
Eventually, we track down the stars, and we talk to the directors, and the mystery is sort of gone. I feel like you can see the cycle happening.
The question is whether was this made with cynicism or with sincerity?
Yeah.
If it's made with sincerity, I feel like it's very easy to keep the cult going. If it's made with cynicism, we're just trying to make a quick buck, we start losing interest.
I think something else happens where it gets a little overexposed. That happened with Troll 2.
Yeah.
You couldn't book Troll 2 as a midnight show anymore. People wouldn't be so interested. I think that one sort of played itself out.
I think, I feel like that happened with the Miami Connection. I feel like everyone was so ready to canonize the Miami Connection. Miami Connection's fun, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
It's about a bunch of martial arts orphan adults who live in the same house together, and they have a band about ninja stuff. Like, they sing about ninja stuff, and then they fight some guys. It's a very entertaining, schlocky movie. But I felt like it was, everyone told me, this is the next big thing. Just accept it now. Oh. That it kind of like, I felt like I was being forced to be amused by that one. Like, maybe it would have been better if that had happened more organically than it had, but okay.
Well, yeah, Miami Connection, it was another one of those things where, I think it was Alamo Drafthouse on Miami Connection. Discovered this, this kind of oddity from, it was 1990 Miami Connection?
Yeah, late 80s, early 90s. Yeah.
And, they decided to clean it up and release it in theaters, saying, this is bug nuts. You guys got to see this.
This is the new Rocky Horror or whatever. Yeah. Well,
and they're trying to sort of prepackage the cult phenomenon. Exactly. And that's exactly what's happening with New York Ninja. Vinegar Syndrome is trying to kind of push this forward as a prepackaged cult thing.
This is a big discovery.
Rather than find this footage and try to recreate it as accurately as possible,
I feel like you're
Well, I'm listening to the score, and I'm listening to the score is sort of the biggest giveaway.
Yeah,
because they're not giving an organic type of score that this movie would have had in 1984.
No, they're giving
a very retro synth kind of.
It's retro synth, denying it. Yeah,
and I feel like that's true of a lot of sort of the editing and maybe even the performances where they're kind of. There's a lot of almost Popeye-like ADR where there's a lot of chattering going on in the background, and like they're clearly just getting a lot of the actors in the booth and playing up the camp a little bit too much.
But you're selling it as though it's like full of like bizarre, wacky dialogue or something like that, and it's not. This isn't like Kung Pao Enter the Fist.
Oh, well, no.
Where they made it
no.
something super campy
and
silly. They're not pumping it full of jokes.
They're not altering what the film is fundamentally,
they're just made it with a bit more of a modern sensibility. Yeah, they're not trying to accurately recreate exactly what it would have been, but there are people who clearly have a taste for the types of movies that they would have seen. They didn't have extensive reconstruction notes like Orson Welles left for Touch of Evil. They're just doing the best that they could, and they thought it worked. And honestly, you know, you find it distracting. I think it mostly looks about right. Mm-hmm. I think it mostly feels about right. The audio is, you know, pretty crap, but I'm used to seeing a lot of movies that were shot without audio in the 70s and 80s that were overdubbed. Sometimes the original audio was lost forever, or was never intended to have original audio, and this is just people cared only so much about how good the performances would be. I'm used to all of that. I actually think that this is actually... who can say if this is exactly how it would have turned out? Probably not. But this reads pretty close to me. This doesn't read like it's winking. This doesn't read like some sort of camp spectacle. This reads for me like people who really enjoy the very sincere genre filmmaking that this is. Early 80s ninja shit. And wanted to put it together as best they could with what they had. And rather than... I mean, you could have, like, busted your ass to make sure everything would have been perfectly period appropriate, and we recorded it in the exact same sound studio that we would have. They're not going to do that. I feel like they get away with it pretty well.
They get away with it pretty well.
As a restoration project, it's an interesting experiment.
That's what it is. It's an interesting experiment. I don't think it's 100% successful. Just because of what I was talking about, I feel like it feels a little bit manufactured to me. Just sort of, they're trying to push the sensibility of this movie in a direction where it doesn't go, rather than just letting it be the piece of crap that it is. And New York Ninja is a piece of crap.
It's a fun piece of crap.
It's
not amazing. To a degree. I've had fun watching this.
It's no Samurai Cop. But, the story is predictable and kind of nonsensical.
Well,
the main character, who's John Liu, has a wife who's murdered right in the first scene.
Yeah, there's a crime wave in New York City. Women are being kidnapped left and right. She sees a woman being kidnapped. She tries to stop it. They kill her. Boom. Now he vows revenge and decides to become a ninja and become a vigilante and stop these bad guys who are being led by the plutonium killer, who is a serial killer driving around in the back of a limousine, who is also completely radioactive.
He's like deliberately irradiates himself, and he's like, he gets high off of it. Like he cackles and, you know, bugs his eyes out.
Which feels like it comes from a different movie, but okay.
And then lures women into the back of his limo, where sometimes he murders them and sometimes he kidnaps and brings to his slavery ring.
Yeah.
Which is like out in the boonies of New York.
It looks like it's on like Shredder's Island from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Like,
yeah.
It's just somewhere out there. You know, like, New York City's all really densely packed, except for this bit.
And it's
this bit right here. There's no one around ever.
And it's visualized by these women who we never see them like engaged in any kind of sexual activity. They're just sort of stripped to their lingerie and tied to what look like bed springs.
Yeah.
Like bed frames without the mattress part.
It's not like in theory and in principle, it's horrifying, but because of the way it's like presented, it feels like no one actually wanted to go there, which is probably for the best, but it's basically just saying like, oh, I don't know. Would you mind just standing there with your hands over your heads? And just like, we'll make this quick. We don't even need to act or anything like that. Just stand there. People get the gist of it. And then we'll do the close ups.
And there are all kinds of weird, bizarre directorial decisions. Like near the end where that ring is finally broken up. Big surprise. All of the women run out and they immediately run over to a flaming drum in the middle of this island and just warm themselves. It's the middle of the day.
Yeah.
It's not cold out.
It was drafty in there.
I guess, but you know, they're being evacuated actively from bad guys that are like wielding weapons and they stop to warm their hands. It's this weird visual choice.
It was cold. I don't know how else to explain it was cold to you, Whitney.
It wasn't just Don the Dragon Wilson who was overacting. John Liu is also clearly visibly overacting.
Yeah, he's hamming it up quite a bit.
Yelling, no, and why? In the middle of kung fu poses.
Yeah.
There's weird aesthetic things that don't make any sense. When his wife dies, he's, you know, of course, completely despondent and mourns by attending her birthday.
Well, it was her birthday, and then he like goes up to the roof where he was going to have a birthday party for her, but it looks like a 5-year-old's birthday.
Yeah, it's like this little tiny card table with like a 5-year-old, a little paper cloth over it and a little cake. Like this was supposed to be her special birthday.
It feels like the PA was sent to Party City with $15.
Yeah.
They're like, we forgot to put something up here. Go to Party City, get whatever you can get for $15, and we'll throw it out.
Now, the movie is cheap and incompetent and nonsensical. Where it excels is the fight choreography.
The fights are actually pretty cool, and there's a couple of bits in there where I'm actually watching this, and I'm like, wow, they had some ambition here. There's the aforementioned bit where he's like zooming down the streets on roller skates in the middle of the day, and it's clear they didn't have a permit. Like, no one knows what's going on.
They're rolling past people who don't know what's going on. They don't know they're being filmed.
That bit's a real hoot. There's a bit towards the end where they have a helicopter. That's not cheap. It's a real helicopter. It's not like they CGI'd some shit. Like, they got a helicopter, and at some point John Liu or someone else in a ninja costume is hanging from that thing by a rope.
Yeah,
and that's dangerous as hell under the best conditions. And actually, given how low budget this movie is, I don't think these were the best conditions.
No,
you're really kind of nervous there for a minute.
There was no concern for safety when you're doing something like that.
Yeah. So that stunt actually came out pretty cool. The visual, it looks like they like never got the shot of the helicopter exploding, so they had to like add that in like CGI in post, and that looks a little incongruous. But what are you gonna do? Hey, you know what? Same problem happened with The Other Side of the Wind. They never got like that last explosion.
Oh, so they had to use
CGI. They had to edit around it and sort of like, the best you can. You do the best you can sometimes. You work with what you got.
And the whole thing is completely bizarre with the plutonium killer. Like, he's not just some mob boss. No. He's like a fucking supervillain.
He's a trauma villain what he is. Yeah. And it's not a trauma film. It's not nearly that bonkers. It's just,
that one element is.
It's just every once in a while there's like one element that's super wacky or one image that's super weird, but it's never the level of consistency you're hoping for with a true Midnight Madness kind of.
Yeah, where it keeps on compounding and every scene has something really wacky in it.
Yeah, it's not that bizarre, but it is.
That's Hard Ticket to Hawaii, where every scene kind of mounts from the previous one.
Exactly.
I like the chauffeur character, the bad guy's chauffeur. Oh, yeah. He's called Rat Tail in the credits. And when he gets ready to fight, he pulls the rat tail on the back of his head over, like, and holds it in his mouth.
So it doesn't, like, whip around.
Yeah, and
he's got, like, a sword cane and shit, and that's kind of fun.
And he clearly did, like, no, like, stage combat training, but he's pretending really well.
Yeah.
And it stumbles also around like he's trying to do drunken style, even though it has nothing to do with actual drunken kung fu.
Yeah, that's what you can tell, yeah.
And I admire his how hard he sold his fake not knowing fight choreography.
Yeah. New York Ninja is they've released this like giant Blu-ray set, which I got, and it's nice. It's a lot of special features on it. It's really cool. And they cleaned it up real good.
And they, yeah. I watched some of those special features, and they really delve into John Liu's career,
mm-hmm.
like who he was and how, like who he was as a child and how he grew up and mm-hmm. you know, where he trained to become this movie fighter and the movies he was in China.
Yeah, Vinegar Syndrome takes this shit real seriously. Yeah. You got to respect that. Yeah.
And yeah, they're clearly going to like the true nerds.
Yeah.
Like the people who live in this world and know all the deep cut information.
If you feel like you've seen every American Ninja movie, and I mean like the American Ninja series, if you've seen everything
I've
Michael
seen all five of them.
If you've seen everything Michael Dudikoff has ever done, if you've seen everything Don the Dragon Wilson has ever done, if you've seen No Retreat, No Surrender more than twice, if you own a copy of Gymkata,
that's a lot of people.
You should see New York Ninja at least once. Yeah, like it's a very entertaining, you know, throwback. Oh, I can't believe I never saw this in the 80s kind of action movie. It's totally worth seeing at least once. There's only like a handful, I think, of people, like a small percentage, they're going to feel the need to own this and revisit it multiple times. But you're out there, and I think it's definitely worth checking out and seeing for yourself.
I'm glad it happened. It's certainly amusing, but in true B movie style, there are a lot of portions where there's just nothing happening.
Mm-hmm.
It's
true.
Yeah, a lot of those old corny B movies are kind of dismissed because they're boring.
Yeah, I think
there's a lot of sequences in those old like science fiction monster movies where there's just guys in white coats standing around in a lab, and the movie ends up being only like 63 minutes anyway.
You know, a lot of those old B movies or grindhouse movies, they only had enough money to do like four cool things.
Yeah.
And so everything in between.
And that only took up like 10 minutes
of
film.
And those four cool things, they're in all the trailers, they're in the posters and everything. And when you get to them, it's totally worth it. The question is, when they have to just fill time in the middle, is it still interesting? And the great grindhouse movies are the ones that are still interesting in the middle. This is one of the reasons why, even though it's got problems and I know you're not allowed to talk about it. And if you look at the movie Grindhouse, like Robert Rodriguez made the movie Grindhouse filmmakers wanted to make. Tarantino made an actual Grindhouse movie, as in there's two cool car bits and a lot of talking. Like a lot of talking at a diner. There's a lot of talking. But when we get to the car bits, hopefully it's worth it. Like, that's the vibe. And that's kind of New York Ninja as well. When it gets to the cool stuff, it's kind of worth it. Mm-hmm. But there's bits in the middle where if you nod off, you're not going to miss anything for 5 minutes.
I feel like there was a way to rescue this film while keeping sort of a little bit more of its B-movie spirit alive.
Okay.
And, you know, not hiring B-movie luminaries, like recognizable cult actors to play some of these parts. Just, mm-hmm.
Bear in mind, they're not that recognizable. I don't know if people could recognize Linnea Quigley's voice out of the ether. Particular group that would recognize Don the Dragon Wilson's voice.
I do suppose so, but in a crowd. Just by hiring Linnea Quigley, just by hiring Don the Dragon Wilson, they're clearly going for a certain kind of audience.
Yeah.
And I think that audience might have appreciated authenticity more than this sort of manufactured cult.
I think it's fine.
It's something I noticed about the movie.
I disagree that it's distracting.
Well, when it comes to cult movies, have to happen organically, don't they?
Agree. Yeah.
And when you try to manufacture it, it feels especially inauthentic.
That's why
something like Troll 2 was such a phenomenon. I think people just kind of discovered it after a while and started passing it around. Before they started making documentary films about it. It was already had a little bit of clout. Same with Samurai Cop. That was the deal with The Room. It kind of grew, and then it outgrew itself. The Room is completely overexposed.
Enters prepackaged as the next big thing, there's a part of you that wants to be like, oh yeah? What you got? That's how it was when I saw Birdemic. I was you gotta see Birdemic. And I'm like, okay, I saw Birdemic. And I'm like, you hyped this up a smidge. I mean, it's bad, but I don't know if it's entertaining bad. I think it's mostly just bad.
I was lucky enough to see Birdemic before... Mm-hmm. I saw it before it was cool, man.
Before the hype.
Well, like, when it was still just sort of like finding its audience in video stores. I owe a lot of sort of my B-movie experience and those HFS movies to Cinephile Video.
Yeah.
A lot of those movies were in Cinephile Video's HFS section. Like, they were the ones who kind of recognized it before they kind of started to get a toehold. So, you know, good on them for being prescient in a lot of these.
Understood. We should move on. What do you want to talk about next?
let's talk about a hero.
Okay, so let's basically just the opposite. A Hero is a new film from filmmaker Asghar Farhadi.
It's about a ninja.
Now, Asghar Farhadi is an Iranian filmmaker. He's won 2 Academy Awards so far for his movie A Separation, which is one of the best movies of the century so far, if you ask me. Mm-hmm. He won for The Salesman.
The Sale, yeah.
Which is a very, very good film about... A Separation is a story of someone who hires a woman to look after his ailing father, and then he gets injured and he kicks her out, and then she gets injured, and then it's a matter of who is more responsible for how badly everything went, and it just starts spiraling, and it's just you know everyone's morally in the wrong, but it's hard to tell who's actually at fault.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a masterful look at that kind of morality. The Salesman is a story of a couple of actors, and one of them is assaulted, and their boyfriend or husband, I forget which, just struggles with how to respond to that, more so even than the victim. He did a great film. I think maybe my favorite film of his is a film called The Past, which is about a man who goes to France to visit his ex-wife and her new family, and he discovers that her family is in... There's something wrong, and he can't put his finger on it, and it turns into a really great detective story as he's trying to figure out what everyone is keeping from everyone else and basically try to solve their problems, but in a way that is really, truly beautiful, and I think the movie is deeply underrated.
What I think Asghar Farhadi is interested in exploring as a filmmaker is the idea of the moral bounds we don't realize we're surrounding ourselves with.
Yeah.
And the judgment that comes with that about how, stigma. I've seen The Salesman, and I like The Salesman a lot.
Salesman's great.
And, sort of that stigma around how we respond to violence.
Yeah.
And this one is about, I think far more penetratingly, about the moral we seem to hang on the notion of debt.
Yeah.
Of being in debt. And I think they even say in this movie, money is not real, but debt is.
Yeah.
And how being in debt can reflect on you morally as a person.
Well, that's a stigma I think a lot of us feel about it. Like, oh, there he's a bad person. He's swimming in debt. Mm-hmm. If he was better, more mature, more intelligent, smarter, cared more about his family, he wouldn't be in this situation.
This idea that we can attach morality to wealth and immorality to lack of wealth. Mm-hmm. And this takes place in a world... straight out of Dickens, where the main character has been released from debtor's prison.
Yeah.
He's owned so much money that he's gone to jail.
Yeah, he took out a loan. A guy guaranteed the loan. His business went bad because shit happens. It's capitalism. And the guy says, I want my money back. He's like, well, I don't have it. It's a lot. And the guy's like, well, that really screws me over. Which it does. He is screwed over, and he says, "Okay, I'm gonna have you sent to prison." At the beginning of the film, our hero, so to speak,
the protagonist
is let out of prison. He's got like a weekend pass to deal with family issues, and the issue is he's leaving his wife. He's got a new girlfriend, and
he and his wife were separated.
They're separated a while ago. He's got a new lover, and she found a purse at like a bus stop that had gold coins in it, and it might be enough to get him out of this mess.
Yeah.
So they're going to go have them appraised, see what they can do, and then over the course of the weekend, he realizes it's not enough to help out, and on top of it all, he starts feeling really guilty about everything. Like, so rather than
taking the coins,
rather than taking the coins and just putting a dent in the debt, he says, "Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go to where it was, where we found it. I'm going to put up some flyers, and if anyone can, describe the purse and say how many coins there were and all that kind of stuff, and prove that it's theirs, we'll give it back to them." And this happens, and he feels pretty good about himself. However, he ends up taking the phone call in prison, and one of the wardens overhears the conversation, and he says, "Is that what you did? You're in debtor's prison, and you gave up free money to do the right thing?" And he was like, "Yeah." And so they end up making this into a public relations story about how great this prisoner is, to sort of gloss over the fact that a guy killed himself at the prison last week.
There's that, and it all very quickly turns into sort of like a local interest news story with a lot of the heart-tugging, heartstring-tugging sort of things.
Yeah, people start raising money to try to get him out of this prison, but he's also not entirely telling the truth about what he did.
Because he was trying to get out of debt, and so he is making decisions, not always the best ones.
Oh yeah, sometimes very bad decisions, but you can always see how he got there.
Not always telling the truth, but always in a way that seems like a logical course of action at the time.
And is the most moral decision he can reasonably make at the time, so even though other people can look from the outside and say, you did the wrong thing.
Now that we have this sort of thing about how you're this great moral guy, how about we get your son to speak? And his son, as it turns out, is suffers from a stammer. He has a speech impediment.
Yeah.
Which kind of adds to this,
every time
this exploitation element about the news stories.
Every time this kid is interviewed or goes up to speak, you can hear him stammer. It just makes his family look more needy.
Mm.
At least that's the perception. And people start realizing that either this kid, that he's either exploiting this kid intentionally or unintentionally. And then we start meeting the person he's in debt to, who, because we're on this guy's side for most of the movie, we're literally just watching it from his perspective, this guy comes across like a total asshole. But the more he talks...
He seems like the villain at the start.
But the more he talks, the more you realize he's not wrong.
He's pointing out a lot of, like, actual flaws that the main character has.
Yeah, and they're talking about, like...
Errors in his story, and why would he lie about that sort of thing?
Yeah, it's like, hey, listen, we put together 1/5 of what he owes you. Surely that's okay, right? It's like, no, that's 1/5. And it's not like... It's not like I'm swimming in cash here. I own, like, a copy store. Like, I don't, like...
He actually needs that money.
This actually, like, I don't have money for my daughter's dowry because of this. You've ruined her life. I think I'm entitled to what I'm owed, not just, oh, he did the right thing after he screwed me over to someone else.
And then it just starts getting worse and worse. Things
just
start mounting and mounting, and the tensions rise, and, there's... more and more questions as to where this money is and what he's going to do. And, he's going to have to go back to prison, having paid any of his debt whatsoever.
Yeah. He's got to eventually have to track down the woman who, like, he didn't get information from the woman who, like, said the coins were hers, and now he's got to find her.
He convinces some family members to sort of tell a certain version of a story. So it looks like they're all lying now when he's caught.
Watching this movie is like watching, like, a detective story set in a Kafka novel. Like, every single aspect of the bureaucracy makes sense on its face, but doesn't necessarily make moral sense. And everyone in it is doing things for their own reasons, but they're not... And most of them are reasonable reasons, or at least reasons you can understand.
Yeah.
And just nothing links up fairly. Everyone's screwed all the time. It's like, life just sucks.
This is an unfair world. You compare it to Kafka. I already compared it to Dickens, because Dickens was very interested in... how society seemed to be constructed very solidly around wealth inequality, and how the poor needed to remain poor, and how difficult, how much we sacrificed ourselves just to get some money. If you've ever read Dombey and Son, that's very much about that. This idea that we have, and this is an important idea to explore in art, just in general. This is a film I was reminded of was L'Argent, if you ever saw it, the Robert Bresson movie from the 80s.
I actually never seen that.
Okay, where somebody tries to pass off a counterfeit bill, and just having this counterfeit bill kind of ruins your life, essentially, and like by the end.
If you're the owner of a counterfeit bill, that's just kind of on you. There's very little you can do about it, other than you can like try to get away with like passing it off, but all you've really done is give away nothing. And you've added nothing to anything, and you're screwing over whoever else has this bill now.
But the idea of like having this counterfeit bill, and just over the course of the film, just by touching it, it's like you've cursed yourself. Money is a curse in that movie. Yeah. It's really, really super anti-capitalist movie. It's an excellent film, by the way. Watch L'Argent. But this one has that same idea that we have constructed so much of what we think of a person as moral to their wealth.
Mm-hmm.
That we are starting to look at a lot of the moral failings of that thinking. There's this idea, and this is something that the charity brings up over and over again, that there's something noble about poverty.
Mm-hmm.
that you can be impoverished. You're impoverished, but you found money, but you gave it back to the rightful owner. Mm-hmm. You didn't keep it. You didn't do
that. Makes you not just like someone who, and even the guy who mm-hmm. like he owes money to even just says, so he found something that wasn't his and he gave it back. That you doesn't should, make him a hero. That's standard decent person procedure. Just because he's in debt doesn't mean he's a hero for not stealing. Yeah. Where's my reward for not stealing?
It's like the Chris Rock bit. I don't hit my kids. What do you want, a cookie?
Yeah, it's the bare minimum anyone can ask of you. That's
supposed to hit your kids.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a weird situation, and I love just seeing the net tighten around everyone in this movie. Yeah. It's so dead. It raises your goosebumps on the back of your neck.
And it's that kind of frustrating bureaucracy that we can all relate to. Yeah. It's also, owing a bill or you know, jury duty, the DMV, all of those really boring scenes in uninteresting locales are the central drama of a lot of people's lives.
And there's something also really bitterly tragic about how the shitty parts of this movie, for the most part, stem from him trying to do the right thing. Every time he tries to do the right thing, it ends up making things worse in some regard. If he had just taken that money, put a dent in his debt, I mean, that woman never would have gotten her coins back. On the other hand, we never see her again.
For all we know,
those weren't even hers. We don't have a good system. We don't really have a confident way of knowing that was like the right thing to do. Mm. All we know is it would have helped him a little, and none of this other shit where he's in the public eye and people are examining him and questioning him, and you know, things seem to go well, but then he goes to another guy and he has to prove everything even twice fold. Now it just ends up making every single thing worse. It's a damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of world, and that's a world that I hopefully we don't recognize constantly, because that would just make you pull your hair out. But we've all had times in our life that felt like that, where just nothing works. The system doesn't work. Nothing is designed right. And if you're trying to do the right thing is important to you, which it should be, but it's not actually getting anyone anywhere. And that's absolutely brain scrambling frustration is just captured really beautifully here.
That hamster wheel existence.
Yeah.
Just sort of constantly running as fast as you can and not getting anywhere.
Yeah.
It's salient. It's important. It has interesting views of money. I really liked it.
Have you not seen many other Asghar Farhadi movies?
The only other one I've seen is The Salesman.
Oh, okay. And I actually think that's of the four I've seen, I think that's my least favorite.
Okay.
So I really hope you see Separation.
I started to watch A Separation, but I can't comment on it because I didn't get very far.
It happens. Well, I want to talk about another film about a guy who made an iffy moral choice and how it affected him in the long term, except this one stars Kevin James and Rob Schneider.
So, well known. They were for their dramatic work.
Respectable
Thespians. Check-off productions together.
Yeah. Who could forget They're Waiting for...
You know, they would make a great... They would do good as Vladimir and Astor Gross.
Actually, I would pay to see them do Waiting for a Good... I'm not going to lie. This is a new film on Netflix called Home Team, and it stars Kevin James, and this is based on a true story that I didn't know about. I don't know how closely, I assume not very, because there's like a scene in this movie where a peewee football team wins a game by projectile vomiting over everybody, so I doubt that really happened, but anyway.
Sometimes art imitates life.
Maybe. Kevin James plays the head coach for the New Orleans Saints. And apparently he was involved in some sort of scandal. The scandal involved, in order to win matches, he incentivized to his team. He would put bounties out on other players. Oh, that linebacker is a problem for us. You get him, you tackle him so hard he's out of the game, you get a bonus, that kind of thing.
Okay.
Sleazy. I don't know the details. It's a scandal. He's barred from coaching for a whole year. So it must be a big fucking deal. The movie never actually engages with how guilty he is of it, which I think is bullshit. Like, at least say it. Come up with a side. You decided that he didn't do it. You decided that he did. I don't buy your movie for a second. Just pick, because I honestly don't know if I hate this guy or not. He decides to spend the off season visiting his estranged family in, I think, Texas. Turns out his son's on a Pee Wee football team and they stink. So he gradually, because he's got more and more time on his hands, starts becoming the head coach of this Pee Wee football team and applying like more NFL type strategies to Pee Wee football.
I've seen this type of movie a couple times.
It's before. The Mighty Fucking Ducks. It's the Bad News Bears. Yeah. It's you've seen this a million fucking times, except this one doesn't know what the fuck it is. I think because it's technically a biopic, they don't want to go too far into making it this, like, it's Happy Madison production. They're known for broad farce. They don't want to go too broad. So everything stays really, really muted. But they also know that they're Happy Madison, everything needs to be light. So no drama is ever really sold too hard.
Yeah.
And anytime there's any kind of comic relief, it's sold so hard that it feels like it's in the wrong movie. There's a character in this movie. Hold on, I want to make sure I get the name right here. Mitch Bizzone is another coach for the Pee Wee team. He's made up to look so much like Kevin James. I thought it was Kevin James in Split Screen.
Just doing some sort of gag.
Yeah, some weird gag where Kevin James gets to play two different characters. And this guy, he's an alcoholic, he's overweight, he's bad with women, he always says the wrong thing. Every time we cut to them, he's like jumping on a table and breaking it. And I don't know why he's in the movie. He has nothing to do with the movie. He's just sort of fucking there. Rob Schneider plays the guy that Kevin James' wife has remarried. He's a new age dude. He's sitting in a lotus position talking about meditating. At one point he says to the kids, hey, we're going to go get vegan ice cream. And the kids are like, yeah, I guess that sounds fine. And it's like, it's not really even a joke. It's just okay. But at no point, it's fine.
Really common.
But the joke clearly is that he's weird, but there's no actual joke there. They just keep cutting to him as though he brought a really big Snuggie. And I'm like, is that a joke? You seem to think it is.
Well, keep in mind, a running theme through, no matter who's directing or who's writing, common theme throughout a lot of Happy Madison productions is cruelty.
Yeah.
Bullying those who are different is a common joke throughout a lot of Happy Madison productions. And I will
say this, that's not quite so much the home team issue. It's not nearly as bad as it is in some of their other stuff.
Just that seems to be something that happens a lot, and you know, we're going to present this really weird person, and they're not weird in a funny way.
Well,
they're weird so that other characters in the movie can mock them.
They have old-fashioned attitudes about masculinity.
Yes.
In a way that is at best here unexplored, but like this idea that his wife remarried this kind of effeminate new age completely unmasculine guy who doesn't get football is treated like a joke, but it's not like they're going to get divorced unless she's going to go back with Kevin James. It's just, he's the funny guy that she married, but you never get the sense. It's so weird. You never get the sense that they're happy together.
Hmm.
Like, is this good for you? Is this a step up for you? Is this what you really, I don't get the sense that like whenever he's doing something weird, she sort of rolls his eyes. Oh, there he goes again. I'm like, okay, fine. But what do you see in him? if you're expecting us to take this seriously enough that we care, you have to actually sell us on these relationships. What's the point here?
I feel like you can't do this anymore, especially not with Kevin James specifically, because this was already satirized in a movie called Neighbors. It had Zac Efron in it and
Seth Rogen
and Rose Byrne. Yeah. And Seth Rogen and Rose Byrne were a married couple.
Yeah.
And Seth Rogen wanted to sort of get into shenanigans with the young frat guys who lived next door, who were led by Zac Efron.
Yeah.
And he kept on saying, let's get into shenanigans. I want to get into shenanigans because, you know, I'm the Kevin James of the relationship. And Rose Byrne says, why can't I be the Kevin James of the relationship? This is, you know, can't I be the doofus and you be sort of like the doting one who's sort of like clicks his tongue and looks aside while I be wacky? Like, how come I don't get to do that?
Yeah.
So it's a very funny moment because they're just sending up this whole notion in Happy Madison.
It's so weird that Kevin James is like wanting to be taken seriously for this because I've seen Here Comes the Boom. I've seen you do the funny sports movie. It's weird to flip that script.
And isn't that one, like, kind of legit? Like, he actually...
It's not bad, actually. I've actually...
He becomes, like, a good fighter
by the end. Yeah, he has become amazing at it. Maybe he's actually able to hold his own in a fight. Like, that's the whole thing is, he works for public school, and in order to pay for public school stuff, he decides to become an MMA fighter. And it kind of works. Like, that's not the terrible movie. As Kevin James movies goes, that's probably one of the better ones. I liked Paul Blart 1. Paul Blart 1 was pretty good. Paul Blart 2 is an abomination. Paul Blart 1, however, not bad. Anyway, my point is this. I'm not anti-Kevin James at all. I'm anti this movie, but not because it's, like, horrible or repugnant. It just doesn't work. Like, nothing about it functions. None of the big emotional beats really hit. None of the comedy really works. There's, like, this one weird bit where, like, he's got to stay at a hotel in town. Okay? He's not going to sleep on his wife's couch. He's going to stay in a hotel. He goes to a hotel, and the guy is like, okay, so we got a presidential suite, and that's kind of it. He's like, okay, I'm rich. I'll pay for that. He's like, cool. All right, it's got a jacuzzi, but the jacuzzi makes noise at night. And he calls down there, and he's like, yeah, the jacuzzi's making noise at night. And the guy's like, yeah, it does that. He's like, oh. That's it. That's the joke. The jacuzzi is constantly making noise at night. It's not a lot of noise. It's not like shocking. It's not grotesque. It's green, but they never really talk about that.
Maybe that's like just a running gag where it like slowly starts driving him insane. You'd over the think course of many scenes.
It happens like three times, but we never actually, there's no resolution to it. Mm. It never makes things harder or funnier. I guess it's supposed to make him sympathetic that this
kind of a sad
well, character. This disgraced rich guy who's still rich and who's going to get his job back in a year. Who did something that is at best unethical, probably quite immoral. We never really engage with how guilty he is, but the implication is that he's responsible for it. Mm. If the best you got to make him sympathetic at the beginning is that the jacuzzi in his presidential suite is a little louder than he'd like at night, and the guy at the lobby can't, like, turn it off... Mm. And no one ever suggests, why don't you get some earplugs? They cost nothing and can be found at any pharmacy. Mm-hmm. I don't have a lot of sympathy for him. Because everything about this movie is weirdly contrived. The only person who actually gets off like without a hitch is Taylor Lautner.
Okay.
Taylor Lautner plays like the kid's coach who was there like before Kevin James rolls along, and he's a really nice guy, and he's a nice coach, he's good with the kids, he just can't win a game to save his life, because the kids just, he doesn't have a good crop of kids, you know, working with what you got, he's genuinely seems to care about the kids and their welfare, whereas Kevin James is more concerned about winning, and he's fine, like, he's one of those guys, like, everyone else in Twilight got a career out of it. Like, Anna Kendrick has a career, Kristen Stewart has a career, Robert Pattinson is Batman now. Like, everyone's doing fucking great except for Taylor Lautner. And I'm going to say it right now, Taylor Lautner deserves a little better than this. Like, he's not amazing, but he deserves better than this. Can we get him better than this, at least?
He didn't return as Sharkboy, did he?
When they did the Sharkboy sequel? Did.
Yeah, I think they got a different actor.
You'd think you could get him. Apparently he's done some TV. He was on Scream Queens, but like, yeah, he's like the last like 6-7 years. He hasn't had a lot on his plate. He was on a show called Cuckoo, which I guess is a sitcom. I've never seen it. Hmm. No one's ever said, "Hey, Bibbs, you want to see Cuckoo?" So I don't know. Maybe it's the best thing ever and I'm just out of the loop. But yeah, I just feel like Taylor Lautner deserves a little better. So that's right. My one takeaway. Taylor Lautner deserves a little bit better than this. Moving on. What do you want to talk about?
Why don't we talk about The House. That's another film from last week.
The House always wins.
This is not to be confused with the 2017 film The House, which is with Will Ferrell and Amy Poehler, who I believe opened like a casino in their home.
Nor should it be confused with the 1980s horror movie House.
Or the 1970s horror movie House. Mm-hmm. This is not House, or The House. This is The House, where this is an anthology animation film done in stop motion. It's a triptych of stories that are all by different
directors? Or?
Yes.
Okay, just checking.
Yeah, each segment's by a different director.
Okay.
Or in the case of the first one, a pair of directors.
Okay.
They're all done in stop motion, and they all center around a domicile of some kind.
Okay. Not the same one, just different houses.
Just different houses. Got it. The first one is a bizarre type of a horror story where a family who's living in a like sort of a countryside cottage learns that some mysterious millionaire has bought up all the land around them and wants to buy their house as well. And in exchange, this mad architect will build a mansion for them, but they have to live in it.
Okay.
The mom and the dad are saying, great, this is wonderful. The young daughter, who is maybe like 7 or 8, she's very young, and she has an infant, like a toddler sister,
yeah,
are a little bit suspicious because they don't want to move out of their house. But the parents get incredibly enamored of this new house. It has a big fireplace. It has a sewing machine. It has big windows, but no curtains.
Ah.
And the mad architect is redesigning it as they're living in it. So one morning, the stairs are gone and they can't get downstairs. So they have to go like down the hallway and into this other vacant bedroom and go down a ladder through a hole in the floor to get downstairs. The next day, it's a different deal. The next day, they can't get downstairs. Mom and dad seem kind of okay with this. And indeed, when the architect asks them to dress like the house, that is like wear paddings that make them look like furniture, these really bizarre outfits, they kind of go along with it. And meanwhile, there's something kind of insidious going on. Like when they look out the window, they see that their old house is being dismantled.
Ah.
And the daughter is completely distraught by watching her house getting dismantled. And the father's like, yeah, they probably just needed something. And he's obsessed with the fireplace, the father. And so we got this butler character comes in and says, well, I know something that you could burn. Here's your favorite chair that you used to sit in. You can burn that. What are they trying to do to this family? They're trying to, like, rob them of their dignity and their identity, like, kind of sacrifice them to the house in this bizarre way.
Sounds creepy.
It's really, really creepy, and because it's a short film, it doesn't have an explanation or even come to a satisfying conclusion.
Oh,
it's
that's just extra creepy.
Mounting misery, and then it just kind of leaves you in this miserable spot. And I love that. I love that kind of ending, because you couldn't have that kind of ending in a feature. That wouldn't be satisfying for a feature.
Toads.
And yeah, but this notion of sort of wandering around a house and having it change around you as you're like sort of going through the house, that's like nightmares I've had. I've seen a lot of movies like that.
I've had so many houses where like dream fans, nightmares where I'm like in my closet and there's like a tiny crawl space that leads to a secret attic I never knew about. And it always freaks me out.
That movie Relic had a scene like that where the Bella Heathcote character wanders into a hallway that is like completely sealed off and she didn't know it was there, and it keeps getting like smaller, and the more she goes and she turns around, it's more cluttered behind her. It's like that kind of stuff. That's a quality of that first short. Chapter 2 is fast forwards to the modern day. And it's about a real estate agent who is fixing up a house and wants to sell it. It's completely modern. And they're all anthropomorphic mice now.
Oh, good.
In the first one, they're all human characters, and they're made with, like, felt. They're, like, really fuzzy, so you can actually see, like, the fuzz crinkle in the animation. I like that kind of handmade look, when you can see the thumbprints.
Yeah.
In the second one, they're all anthropomorphic mice. And the realtor mouse character is dealing with a lot of small problems. Like, there's an infestation. There's, like, bugs.
Mm-hmm.
And so, trying to fix up this flat so he can rent it out. And, of course, everything goes wrong at the showing. They deliver the wrong groceries. Everything's just sort of, some bugs crawl out at the wrong moment. They can't show off the rotisserie oven because the chicken never came. And then all of the wired-in sound is wired into his phone, and then he drops his phone, and everything goes haywire.
Yeah.
But two people stay, a rat and a weasel.
Okay.
And they behave in a very strange fashion. Say, yes, we'd like to buy this house, but we'd like to stay the night first.
Okay.
And at the end of his rope, he says, well, fine, you can stay in the house. Good. We're going to stay longer. We've invited our family. And slowly, more and more people start moving into the space. They begin, trashing it. You know, they're just sort of sleeping on the floor and, like, knocking over furniture and, like, leaving handprints on the walls. And, of course, the bugs start crawling out, and pretty soon it's just completely destitute. And that one also leaves us in this, like, unsatisfying, creepy location. So, cool. You have these sort of two horror movies about houses.
Next up, a fart competition.
Not quite. The third one's about kitties.
Oh, that's nice.
Anthropomorphic cats.
I've got a cat in my foot right now. And it's hanging out.
And, hey, Luca. And this is similar to the second one in that it's about the owner of this sort of seaside cottage that has a lot of extra bedrooms, and she wants to rent it out
to cats.
To other cat people.
Okay.
She has two clients who are living there. One's a deadbeat who only pays her in fish, and the other is this sort of like new age crystal worshiper who pays her in crystals.
Okay.
And she's like, well, and she even go.
I
like
kind of
want to
move there just so I can pay her in screeners.
Yeah. Here, would you like a sweatshirt for Tick Tick Boom?
Would you like a link to a movie starring Alicia Silverstone fighting a shark? It's only good until 10 o'clock.
Well, I'm cooking dinner. Watch it now. Those expiring screeners, man.
Ah, they're always the worst.
The worst are when they give you a screener that's only available for the length of the film. It's like you start at 7:30 or you don't see it at all.
Yeah, or it'll just stop playing with 5 minutes to go. Like, yeah. what's the point?
She has a really sort of egalitarian conversation with the crystal worshiper. It's like, hey, thank you for paying me in crystals. I understand they're supposed to align my chakras or whatever.
Mm.
But I need to fix this place up, and I can't buy wallpaper paste with crystals. And then a new character comes in. He floats in off of the sea. It's right by the seaside. And he is named Cosmos. And he is also this sort of like new age hippie. And it's like, you want to stay in the house? No, I stay in my yurt. He sets up his yurt like in a second. It's like, and I'm going to stay here and I'll fix up the place. And she's like, great. You know what? If I can have just a handyman living around, fix it all up. Do what you want.
Yeah.
The next morning, he's ripped it apart.
Ah.
And he's added a big lever to the house, and he doesn't say what it does.
Okay.
The fog is getting thicker, it's seeping in, the wallpaper's falling off, and she is just getting completely frustrated. It's almost like a slow burn comedy. Do you ever see that film, The Money Pit?
Yeah, I did see The Money Pit, yeah.
It's sort of like
that. It's about a house that doesn't work.
And it's sort of this bizarre sort of frustration comedy until it becomes about the afterlife.
What?
So there's this twist near the end.
All right.
And we finally learn what that lever does.
Sounds fun.
Stop motion is a very labor-intensive form of animation.
Yeah.
It takes a long, long time to make because there aren't a lot of shortcuts.
Yeah.
You make the models, you pose them, you have to build these tiny little sets, and you just have to take picture by picture. And there's no way to speed up that process.
Not without like combining it with other things.
No, I know with Leica, they've actually revolutionized 3D printing to do a lot of that. To do instead of sculpting everything by hand.
Yeah.
They just 3D print a lot of those models. Mm-hmm. So they're able to make the models a lot faster, but they still have to photograph in the slow process.
Yeah, they still have to actually switch all the faces around and stuff like that, and that takes time, yeah.
There's a lot of fun outtakes at the end of Leica movies where they show the animation, but they leave in some frames with the animators in frame.
Yeah.
So you see them like zipping about really fast.
It's really cool.
While the animation just sort of moves at its normal pace.
Yeah, the Box Trolls is a really amazing one of those because it's in the middle of a conversation.
Yeah.
The characters are having voice super
weird.
Yeah,
voice in the actors. As such, it's not utilized in feature films a lot. You'll see it in short films and, you know, at the Academy nominated shorts occasionally, but it's a really fantastically alive animation form that I'm very fond of.
Yeah.
Like I said, I like it especially when you can see the thumbprints, the earlier Wallace and Gromit shorts, where you can actually see the thumbprints on Wallace and Gromit before they started to sort of slick them out and use computers to sort of streamline it a little bit. And there's a kind of a jerky quality to it that I think, like, it's a little peculiar, but it makes it look a lot more alive. We commented on stop motion animation for a recent Star Trek episode, Conspiracy, where there's a little stop motion bug, and how it looks really corny because it doesn't look real.
But also
at the same
looks otherworldly.
Time,
it doesn't look like something that it exists, but it does look like something that takes up physical space.
Mm.
And as a result, if you're going for some sort of monster effect, you can hardly do much better. Because that's clearly real, that's clearly tangible and physical. It doesn't have that, like, annoying glossy sheen that even some of the best CGI still has some of these days. But, yeah, there's something just a little unnatural about how it moves, and it scares the crap out of you if you do it right. Yeah,
and I appreciate that unnaturalness when it comes to stop motion. So, this is great look. Okay. They all look a little bit different. The design on the mice is a little bit eerie. I liked the felt people in the first short. Yeah. The third one is a little bit more conventional. Like the cats have a little bit more traditional, like Disney eyes and like the big heads and the skinny bodies kind of design.
And it's just the three. Is there like a wraparound device, or is it just three?
Just three short films.
Okay, cool.
Just sort of centered around houses.
Okay.
And I like that. I like that they're just sort of thematically connected. There doesn't have to be a wraparound for...
Yeah, very reasonable.
For a triptych kind of film. And I like that they're packaged together, because they kind of comment on each other about how fears and anxiety and death can all be linked very intimately with the home, with the place where you live, and how that those spaces kind of get inside you in a way that you may not really fully realize.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I dug it. It's on Netflix. Cool. Yeah, cool. Watch it. British film.
Well, I saw another animated film this week, and this is an interesting case because usually when I see a film in a series, I try to be familiar with the entire series. I figure that, the target demographic for it is people who've seen the rest of the films. But sometimes you just can't.
Mm.
Sometimes you don't have the time or the capacity to see every single film in, say, I don't know, the Ice Age series. Ice Age is a film, I've seen about three or four of them. The original Ice Age was basically a remake of that Western Three Godfathers, which was later remade by
Satoshi Kon
as the Great Tokyo Godfathers. And it's about three mismatched adults who find a baby and go on an adventure to try to help the baby find, hopefully it's actual parents, but at least someone to take care of it. And along the way, these people who don't like each other form a makeshift family around the shared act of caring for another being. The original Ice Age is pretty good, honestly. It's fine. It works. It's the animation style is a little bit more stark and stylized than a lot of CGI films of its era, so it stands out a little bit. It's got a slightly more serious dramatic tone because it actually cares about things and has stakes. It works fine. I fell out a little bit over the years as they kept on having adventures, and I would just sort of dip in like, oh wait, what's going on now? The Ice Age is melting. That was a quick Ice Age. The same characters are still around. What did it last, like 5 years? How the hell does that happen?
Ice Age The Meltdown. Age of Dinosaurs.
Age of Dinosaurs. I didn't see Age of Dinosaurs. Age of Dinosaurs. They had dinosaurs, and I didn't see it. There was Ice Age Continental Drift, which I did. There was Ice Age Dawn of Dinosaurs.
Dawn of Dinosaurs.
There was Ice Age The Meltdown, Ice Age Dawn of the Dinosaurs, Ice Age Continental Drift, which I saw and I couldn't tell you anything about if you had a gun to my head. I remember that some of them end up on a glacier and they're floating away because the Ice Age is over, which seems like a bad choice for the series, but okay. And then there was Ice Age Collision Course, where I guess they all hit each other.
I think that's about a meteor. Like, it's about the...
Sure.
We're up to number six is the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody's paid attention.
Kids, I guess, are seeing these things. They're making money. But this is one of those franchises that Disney acquired when they acquired Fox. They own Ice Age now.
The Blue Sky Animation Studio put out Ice Age.
Ice Age used to be one of the few animated franchises that could actually compete with Disney at the box office. And now Disney just owns it. And they decided
Blue Sky.
Blue Sky's gone. This is a vestigial remnant of Blue Sky. I heard somewhere this might have been like intended originally as a TV series, and they decided to make it into a movie. But regardless, they figured this one is not worth releasing in theaters, and admittedly, I get it.
Who is Buck Wild?
Buck Wild is the character who was apparently introduced in Ice Age Dawn of the Dinosaurs, and I missed it.
All right.
Buck Wild is a ferret or something? He's some kind of marsupial or small rat creature.
Well, one of the appeals of the Ice Age movies is they animated animals you don't typically see in movies.
Yeah.
That is extinct mammals.
Yeah.
So it's mammoth, saber-toothed cat, two-toed sloth, and...
And others as well.
And others as well.
Yeah. So that's kind of fun.
Large rhinoceros.
So,
antecedents.
Some kind of mongoose or something. That's Buck Wild. And he's got an eye patch and he lives in the Lost World. He lives in the dinosaur world, which apparently has always been like two doors down from the other characters, and they just never visit anymore because it was kind of annoying. There's a character, Ellie, who is the lady Mastodon, who was played in the original movies by Queen Latifah. The movies starred folks like Queen Latifah and John Leguizamo and Ray Romano and
Dennis Leary,
and none of them could be bothered to come back for this one.
That's nobody.
They're all sound alike. Some of them sound... Ray Romano has a voice that's relatively easy to copy. He's got a very distinctive kind of delivery, so the Ray Romano Mastodon sounds more or less right. But everyone else, they're trying, they're fine. It's just they don't sound quite like the originals. And it turns out that Ellie, the Mastodon, was raised as an opossum with two opossum buddies. And the possum buddies apparently are idiots. They're stupid characters who do stupid things and endanger things. But they're really, really fun, so kids are supposed to like them. And basically, they've decided that they're old enough now that they can actually go out on their own and have their own adventures. So they decide to do that. Everyone's like, oh, no, those guys, you better find them. So they start looking for them. But they decide to go to the Lost World. And when they're in the Lost World, they run into Buck Wild, who's cool and stuff and has, like, his own swinging bachelor pad where, like, he's the father of a pumpkin. And the pumpkin, like... he's been living on his own long enough that he's decided that a pumpkin's his daughter and, like, he's concerned about her. And they're going to live with Buck Wild. Everything's going to be great. Except one of the dinosaurs, which is like a Styracosaurus, like one of those, it's like a Triceratops, but it's got like a bigger kind of like scoop at the back of the head.
Okay.
One of those dinosaurs has decided to be evil because on the other side of that big swooshy bit at the back of its head is a giant exposed brain. And every time we see it, it scares the shit out of me.
That's, it would be a Protoceratops.
I guess it's a Protoceratops.
Protoceratops were known for their large brains.
And they're visible outside the body?
No, they just had big heads.
Yeah, they're visible, like you could see,
as far as we could see,
you could see, like, the little wormy crags in the brain, like, on the outside. And you can, like, punch him in the brain, and it makes him, like, ugh. Like, okay, and I'm like, all of this is freaking me out, and I wish we were doing none of it.
If they did a joke, like, they punch him in the brain, he's like, toast. You know, yeah. Something like, yeah.
Something, maybe. It turns out that Buck Wild used to be part of a superhero team in the Lost World with a couple of other animals, only one of whom is still alive. She's some kind of not skunk. Like, it looks like a skunk, but it's not a skunk.
She's a Zorilla.
She's a Zorilla. Her name is Z.
All the stuff you learned at the Natural History Museum.
I'm so glad Whitney paid attention. And there's several instances in which she makes a lot of stinky. And they're like, oh, well, why don't you use more stinky to fight all these velociraptors that are attacking us? And she's like, I just unloaded my stink pouch. It takes a while. And we're all just sort of sitting there going... I didn't really want to think about that. I guess we're just going to dwell. We're going to dwell on that. That's what we're going to dwell on. Cool. It all ends in violence because, of course, that's how it's going to be resolved.
Was the head of a superhero team.
It was the head of a superhero team in the Lost World.
In the Ice Age.
Underneath the Ice Age in the Lost World, which is underground but has the sun.
When you have penguins as spies...
Well, that's Madagascar
series. That's Madagascar. I can roll with that because they live in the modern world.
Yeah.
And they have access to things like spy jets. Spies are very technocentric.
Agreed.
What does a superhero weasel do in the Ice Age?
They protect the watering hole.
Okay, from bad guys who would poison it?
If anyone wants to not be nice at the watering hole, they'll stop them. The Protoceratops wanted to take over the watering hole. And they're like, this is the same plot, by the way, as like the Jon Favreau Jungle Book. Where it's like, Shere Khan is just like, I will take over this watering hole. And then I'm going to put on a business suit and start an air travel business in the Caribbean.
Oh, you know what? If they took that same photorealistic Jungle Book and made Tailspin,
I asked Jon Favreau if they could do it. And he said, we have all the assets. If we can get convinced Bill Murray, we can do it. And I'm like, oh my God, please do it. It never happened. But it could have happened. It never did. This movie is so cheap. It looks cheap. There's so many shots of like people talking where they're like kind of like frame out their mouth so you don't have to see it. Like that's kind of cheap.
That's really cheap.
Cheap trick. There's a lot of cheapness to it. There's a lot of pointlessness to it.
The characters are designed to be like blocky looking.
Often, like, yeah,
they're really angular kind of characters.
They've moved a little bit away from that, I think is a mistake because that gave Ice Age a distinctive look. Hmm. And listen, I know it's for kids. I get it. I realize that kids don't have the elevated standards that a lot of adults have. And hey, listen, we liked New York Ninja. We have only so much right to complain if something sucks, right? Like, there's something to be said for it. However, this isn't like, and I've seen kids movies that like have like ugly messages that I think they teach kids. Mm. Like Rio 2 is a movie no one else talks about but me, but Rio 2 is a shitty message about basically caving into emotionally abusive relationships, and that makes everything okay. That's a terrible message to give to kids. That does not work. In addition to not being a very good film. This is at least mostly harmless. Like, this, I don't think anyone's going to get any, like, I feel like it probably shouldn't have to be resolved with violence at the end. That might have been a stronger message for kids, but they're trying to treat it like a superhero motif. I kind of get it. This is not challenging. This is not interesting. But my point is this. You're making it for kids, but it's made by adults who have to spend so much time making this. You'd think they could have entertained themselves more. You'd think something that takes this much effort, even on the lower end of the spectrum, in terms of like how much time they probably had, the money that they have to make it, you'd still think you'd want to create something a little more entertaining than this.
That's a danger, though, because you know that's what the DreamWorks animation studios kind of fell into from time to time, where it'd be like almost all contemporary references for the adults.
I feel like that's such a fallacy, the assumption
your Shreks and your Shark Tales.
But I feel like what I'm saying here is everyone always assumes like, oh, so you want to have like a bunch of dated pop culture jokes? Mm. No, I just want it to be the kind of thing an adult might actually not hate watching. Hmm. Like, I don't feel like we need it to feel like an episode of Mad TV. I just want it to maybe be told in such a way that the jokes are well-timed and funny. Or maybe the character beats work and actually mean something. Maybe you could have something to say that matters in the end. Like something, I don't know, like it's something like that might have been great. Instead, it's kind of a waste of time. It's a time waster kind of movie. It's a movie that's like, hey kids, this is almost 90 minutes. Sit down and shut up. Like, that's kind of this movie.
Yeah,
Your kids aren't going to get anything out of it other than 90 minutes will have passed by the time it's over. Yeah, however long it is.
I'm not a fan of the Ice Age movies. I didn't even like the first one
I think the first one's fine. I really do. It's a perfectly decent kids movie.
It's fine. I wasn't fond of the character designs. I thought it was novel to set it in the Ice Age with mammals. They just never worked for me. I just didn't like the characters that much. I think John Leguizamo's sloth voice just got on my nerves. So I kind of pushed the whole series aside. But there was one saving grace, and that was the character of Scrat.
Yeah, Scrat.
Scrat is as funny a comedic animation creation as anything from the classic Warner Brothers canon.
Scrat is a little mouse-type creature who is constantly trying to rescue his acorn. He's like putting an acorn away for the winter, and there's something always happens that ends up becoming like apocalyptically terrible. A mountain falls on him, he gets shot into space.
In one, he like literally gets caught at the core of the earth and rips Pangaea apart just trying to get a single acorn.
Yeah.
And Scrat is bodily abused in ways that are hard to imagine. Like, they've found new ways to mutilate an animal. And I've seen a lot of Roadrunner cartoons.
That's the vibe I get from it. It's the same joke over and over again. The gag is, how can we keep this joke funny? And it turns out, if you're creative, you can do it.
Yeah, how many times have you seen the coyote die? Well, a lot, and they're...
It's funny pretty much every time.
Chuck Jones was funny about it.
Yeah, they had new ways to sort of surprise you with how everything was going to go horribly wrong. And that's kind of how Scrat worked. It's how bad can things go for Scrat. So I'm particularly pissed that Scrat isn't even in this one.
That was going to be my next question. Is there a Scrat short beforehand?
No Scrat whatsoever. Scrat is not in it. And not even an unrelated pre-credits bit. Just no Scrat at all whatsoever.
Then what's the fucking point?
I can't imagine. without the Pink Panther.
If I'm
going to
see an
like,
Ice Age film, I want the Scrat short. That's what I came for.
There's certain things.
Because I love Scrat.
It would be like if at the end of a Godzilla movie, instead of fighting King Ghidorah, they played chess. Like, okay, I admire your ingenuity for trying to like mix up this franchise, but we paid to see them fight.
It sounds more like they face off, they meet at the battlefield, and then King Ghidorah just flies away.
Yeah.
And Godzilla just sort of stands there.
And it's like, oh, well, that's a little anticlimactic, but good, you learned your lesson.
You I've
defeated you several times, and you're like, okay, fair enough. Yeah. But yeah, that was my biggest, honestly, that is the biggest complaint. I'm glad you mentioned it, is that there is no Scrat, which is a huge waste. What is that? Such crap.
It's the best thing to, one of the best things to come out of Blue Sky. I like the Peanuts movie too.
Peanuts movie's good. The Blue Sky did Captain Underpants?
No, that was DreamWorks.
Oh, okay. What's the Blue Sky do?
Blue Sky also did, I think they did the, no, DreamWorks also did the Rio movies.
Okay, here's what they did. They did Ice Age, they did Robots, Horton Hears a Who.
Okay.
Rio. The original Rio's fine, I guess. Epic, which is one of the most forgettable movies I've ever seen. Like, tell me anything about the movie Epic, I dare you. They did Rio 2. They did the Peanuts movie, which is pretty good. It's, I think they kind of missed the point at the end, but it's not bad. They did Ferdinand, which I didn't see. They did Spies in Disguise, which I didn't see.
I saw Spies in Disguise.
They were going to make an adaptation. This pisses me the fuck off, because this was actually like in the works, but because the studio closed, they're not going to do it. They were going to adapt this really wonderful comic book called Nimona, which was this very witty sort of Middle Ages fantasy story about a shapeshifter who decides to help a bad guy become a better bad guy. It's really good. It's a really, 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 really good comic, and I think you should check it out. But alas, it's not going to be turned into a movie, at least not anytime soon. Real bummer.
Yeah, and because of the nature of these big, like, sort of studio buyouts or, you know, studio heads change hands, those projects are always scrapped.
They're never
like pass it on to the like, next administration.
Eventually, the rights will lapse, and maybe someone will buy it up, but that's probably not.
Yeah, I know that's what happened with Clive Barker at Disney. Yeah. Like, Disney changed hands, somebody took over, this, like, epic project he was working
on. Did you see, when Fox was bought out, they were in the process of making, I think, a Redwall movie.
Oh, the...
Yeah. No, not Redwall. It was the one with Mouse Guard. They're making a Mouse Guard movie, which is this sort of action-adventure epic about mice heroes. And, someone like they showed like some test animation and like some of like the behind the scenes stuff that they were making for it, and it looked unbelievably cool. Like, it looks like a really stunning work of animation. And Disney was like, we don't see any money in it, and they just said no, even though it was already being made. It sucks so much.
And now they're just not going.
Well, we got Buck Wild out of it.
Thank goodness. Well, it's.
Moving on. What else you got? That's it for everything I've seen this week.
Okay, well, I've seen two other films.
Yep.
I saw A Taste of Hunger, which is a Norwegian film starring Nikolai Coster-Waldau. He was in Game of Thrones. Yeah. He was also the lead in Gods of Egypt.
Yep, that's true.
So he's been in a few like American and British productions, but he mostly works in Norway. And I got to interview him for this movie.
Ooh, how was he?
Very kind man.
Cool.
He was very tired because it was late. He was back in Norway, so
big time difference, huh?
Big time. Yeah, it was like
did you ask a bunch of Gods of Egypt questions?
No, we had 10 minutes. I didn't get.
Yeah, but you got to throw in at least one, right?
Well, he was long winded, and in an interview you never interrupt. You just let him.
No,
talk.
No, you never say, shut up. I have another question. Like, no, you want people to tell stories, so like you never shut him up. Yeah. But yeah, they're long-winded. You only get a chance to ask like two or three questions. So
but in A Taste of Hunger, Nikolai Coster-Waldau plays a restaurateur named Karsten, and his restaurant might have just been visited by the Michelin guy.
Nice.
That is the critic who awards Michelin stars,
which is like the ultimate like award for restaurants, and they've come in secret. You're not supposed to know who it is. In movies, they always know, like, oh, the big food critic is like, no, you're not supposed to know who it is.
Yeah.
They're supposed to get the food that everyone else gets.
So he's really stressed out, I think. And he's even sent people out into the world to sort of check to see, have other restaurants around town seen this person? And that might be the Michelin person. Keep an eye on that. Are they, if they go to, like, a lot of ritzy restaurants in a condensed period, that's a good sign. So, and he is in... what's kind of become a cliche, you know, a complete hard ass in the kitchen. He's just needs perfection. Mm-hmm. He demands this. And we get to see in flashbacks how obsessed he is with food and cooking.
Okay.
How he, you know, when he, even when he's just having casual dinners with the family and they don't care what they're eating, he insists on things being done a certain way. And he gets really mad at his young daughter when she drops like an egg. Okay. It's like, oh no, we needed that. That was the only one we had. Ugh. And, you know, he almost yells at his daughter because she messed up a dish because he really believes in it. It's also not his movie.
Oh!
He is, while he's busy sort of going through this drama and living through, you know, the way he prepares food and really focused on the kitchen, his wife, who's played by an actress named Katrine Grease Rosenthal, has seen in his mail a little folded note that says, "Your wife is having an affair."
Oh!
Which she is.
Oh!
So she finds the note and doesn't know who wrote it or who left it there.
Mm-hmm. But she's not going to steal his mail, right? She's got to leave it back on the pile.
Yes, of course. That's exactly what she's going to do.
You don't be a dick about it. That'd be unethical. It'd
be unethical to steal mail.
Yeah. I may be cheating on my husband, but I'm not unethical.
But the movie is mostly about her racing from place to place, trying to find who wrote this note, who knows about her affair, the young man she's having an affair with.
Right.
And to essentially get the situation under control and keep the secret. She doesn't want her husband to find out.
Is the twist that she's sleeping with the Michelin critic?
No, that's not the twist.
Okay. That would be a fun twist.
No, there's no actual twist. It's, it's pretty straightforward.
All right,
It is about how the secrecy is breaking her down.
Okay.
And the panic that she's going through trying to cover up her affair. And of course, there's a lot of, like I said, there's a lot of flashbacks. So we also get to see how she met the man she's having an affair with, the reasons she decided to have an affair.
Right.
And it sounds kind like of how their relationship was starting to sour before she started sleeping with this other man.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Like, it sounds like she's in a whirlwind trying desperately to make sure that to save her marriage. Does she want to save her marriage, or is it just out of
At first it's like just to save face and sort of keep the status quo. It's like, no, I just want to, and you know, you would think that if she stops it, she'd probably just keep on having the affair.
Yeah.
But after a while she realizes kind of how important it is, and eventually the truth comes to light.
Mm-hmm.
And I mention that because the movie goes on for a little while after.
Okay. That's
it's not
cool.
Just about sort of this big confrontation right at the climax. There's actually a lot of communication had thereafter, and sort of the nature of their changing, you know, what their family dynamic is going to be like moving forward.
I like that. I haven't seen it. I like it in theory, though, because so often, like, the movies end with, like, or a sitcom or whatever, like, oh, I swear I'll change. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, yeah, anyone can do that when, like, in the heat of the moment, when you're caught and you feel like this is the moment to say that. Mm-hmm. The question is, in a couple of days when everything dies down, you actually going to do it? Are you actually going to put in the work? Are you going to go to therapy? What are you going to do?
Are you really going to stay together? Are you going to break up? If you do break up and you have a kid, how is that going to work out?
Because you got here probably because you're stuck in a cycle, right? You have patterns of behavior. Breaking those isn't necessarily easy, and just promising you're going to do it isn't enough. You actually have to put in a lot of effort. So I don't always buy at the end of these movies that everything is going to be okay.
But the Nikolai Coster-Waldau character, well, he seems like, you know, he's the aggrieved party here. His wife was cheating on him, and he's not happy about that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he has to sort of acknowledge that the one thing that he's passionate about and the thing that he's working hard to get is, like, this restaurant is pushing everybody away.
Yeah.
And we even get to see a scene where they first met, he and his wife, and how she really doesn't care that much about food. She's never had a hot dog before.
Oh.
And he has to cook her, like, the finest hot dog ever. It's like, oh, just whatever. I'm just drinking.
Yeah.
She cares more about booze. She has a lot of cocktails throughout
the movie. She can be the restaurant sommelier.
She's not alcoholic, but she's a connoisseur.
Well, yeah, that's fine. Don't necessarily go hand in hand.
Yeah. Well, like I said, she's always drinking a cocktail. She's not, like, indiscriminately a lush. She's just, you know, drinks the way an adult, European does.
So does it work?
So it does work. I think there's some emotional maturity in there in terms of the way these characters relate rather than relying on cheaper melodramatic beats. It's pretty good.
That sounds really good. All right. And then lastly, we have a new film that's going straight to HBO Max called The Fallout.
That's right.
What is The Fallout?
The Fallout is a new film from director Megan Park.
Okay.
And it stars, what's her name? Jenna Ortega from Scream.
Oh, she's great.
She was just in Scream.
Yeah, very talented actor.
She's much better here.
I thought she was fine in Scream, but I'm glad to hear she's even better here.
Yeah, she's 16 years old. She's going to high school. She has a younger sister. The opening scene is she's really bonding with her younger sister. Her younger sister trusts her a lot. And there's a rather frank scene right at the beginning where the younger sister has just had her period and calls her older sister first and says, oh, what is happening? What's going to happen? And she actually kind of talks her down. It's like, congratulations. This is actually a really cool thing. I'll tell you all about it the next time we're together. It's going to be really wonderful. She goes to the bathroom. In the bathroom is one of the high school's like sort of star dazzling popular girls. And she's like an Instagram star and a star dancer. But she's not vapid or shallow as those characters tend to be in these movies.
Oh, okay.
And while they're in the bathroom, a school shooting takes place.
Oh, God.
So they hide together. Somebody runs in and joins them in the stall to hide from the shooter, and he's covered in blood. Very traumatic thing. They hear the gunshots. The guy they're hiding with, it turns out his brother just got shot out in the hallway, so he's covered in his brother's blood.
Oh, my God.
And then the movie starts to follow the aftermath, the fallout of it.
Yeah.
There's a rather damning montage of her opening up a little keepsake box and putting in a card from a funeral, and then another, and then another, and then another of all of the people who died in the school shooting. And the way she handles it is, I think, depicted in a pretty frank, realistic fashion, where, like, how she's dealing with her grief is to sort of run from it a little bit, cut herself off, not be, like, she says that she feels a little bit numb, but she also feels a little bit flip. She's actually, like, trying to behave as normally as possible. And there's no cracks in that facade. This is the way she's dealing with it. And it becomes more about moving forward with that in her past than it is about how the grief is constantly hanging on her. It's not necessarily about the grieving process. It's about just sort of her emotional journey and the kinds of things she needs to go through in order to feel like she's retaining some sense of normalcy. She does eventually go to a school counselor who's played by Shailene Woodley. I like Shailene Woodley.
Seems like she'd be kind of young for that role typically.
Shailene Woodley's like 31 now.
She's like 31 now? My God, when did that happen?
she played a teenager for 15 years.
So like, that means she's still a teenager, right? No, that just means... That tracks. Okay. Yeah. Cool. Is she good in this?
Shailene Woodley turned 30 in November.
It's perfectly fine. It's just when you keep casting these people as teenagers, it warps our sense of how old they are.
It's kind of sad how many coming of age dramas I've seen with Shailene Woodley. She's 24. She's 28. She's still a teenager. She plays the school counselor, and she's trying to sort of enact a lot of the cliched psychological language. And Jenny Ortega, she doesn't reject it, but it doesn't seem to fit what she's going through. Meanwhile, she starts kind of developing this friendship with the popular girl that she was hiding with. She's played by an actress named, let me look her up, Maddie Ziegler.
I know that name.
I know Rachel Ziegler has been in Public Eye recently.
They're not related, right?
No.
I don't think so.
Maddie Ziegler plays a character whose parents have been in Japan for a long time. They're still in Japan. There's been a school shooting and they don't come home. So she's just in this gigantic palatial mansion by herself, drinking her parents' red wine and hanging out with Jenny Ortega.
Maddie Ziegler, I didn't see it, but she was in that movie Saya directed, Music.
Oh, I didn't see
Music. Yeah, I'd heard many a thing, but I never got around to it. Yeah. So, all right, that's what I was thinking of.
Well, she's fine in this. Good. I know Music is of much malign, but I haven't seen it. And it's pretty clear from the jump that these two girls are falling in love. That they're having this kind of growing romantic sexual friendship together that is kind of based more on social interaction than passion, because they're both in this really awkward place in their lives. And this is a weird place to start falling in love or start having a relationship. also, neither of them has really sort of come out or stated their sexuality, so they're also both kind of figuring that out.
Yeah.
Jenna Ortega also has a dalliance with a man during the course of this movie, another teenager, a boy.
Yeah.
But, you know, she's not, this isn't about her sort of coming to terms with her sexuality. This is just about her exploring who she is.
Yeah.
And this is a fine place to explore these sorts of things, these extreme emotional places. And she has to come to peace with the fact that this is doing damage in ways that she can't even really fathom yet.
Yeah. That's going to echo.
Like, it doesn't even feel like damage has been done because she doesn't really understand the context of it yet. She's just sort of like floating through this.
You have no idea how this is going to affect things that happen to you in the future. Yeah,
this fallout only takes place like maybe like 2 weeks after the shooting.
Ah.
So it is about the sort of immediate reaction rather than the long-term dealing with, you know, grief and trauma, which I appreciate because I think that is a lot more emotionally honest about the way grief and shock operates than going through a lot of these sort of textbook beats about the stages of grief.
Yeah, here's what it's going to be like for you. Here's almost like a how-to.
Anger, denial, acceptance, all the rest of that stuff.
How does this stack up? Because there have been a lot of movies that have dealt with the topic of school shootings, because sadly there have been infinitely too many of them. I've said everything from Gus Van Sant's Elephant to Mass came out last year.
Yeah.
There was that what was that awful Oscar winning short?
Something like the call something.
Never Forget I Love You or something like that.
Right, that one.
Yeah. Boy, was that. I understand what they were going for. I don't think that worked at all.
I thought there was also one from a few years previous about the administrator who had the shooter in the office with her.
Oh, yeah. See, that was a live action story. That was actually pretty well handled, actually, I thought. But how do you feel this like fits into the tapestry of what has sadly been forced to become a subgenre?
It's become a subgenre, and there was a scene, if you remember, in the movie Eighth Grade, where they're having a shooter drill.
Yeah, that was weird.
And the kids are bored.
Yeah.
They're as bored as they are when we had fire drills, earthquake drills here in Southern California. This has become such a common thing that when they do these shooter drills, it's like, oh, we just get out of class for 10 minutes. And as such, I think this is from a new perspective. A lot of the previous school shooter movies have been dripping with sadness because this is a horrendous act and the horror was always put at the forefront. This one is a weirdly a lot frank and as such a little bit, it's not making light of it, but is of a lighter tone.
Okay.
Where it is trying to look at sort of the foibles and everything, the ups and the downs of everything that somebody goes through immediately following these things. And they're still able to make jokes and have fun when something horrible has just happened in their lives, because they're still humans and they're still going to have the capacity for that. And eventually the main character does kind of come to terms with things. And then it has just a beautiful ending that shows just how deep the wounds are really running.
Sounds really good.
Yeah. So it's really tactfully handled in a way I haven't seen this sort of tragic event handled before.
Awesome.
Where it's not trying to put the tragedy of the event at the forefront, but the humanity of it.
Okay.
And that's something I appreciate.
That sounds really good. Well, anyway, let's review some movies. So at the end of Very Critically Acclaimed, we review our new releases on a scale of C- to C+. Most movies have some good and some bad. Those are C. Average. You know? Not amazing, not bad either. It's fine. C- is below average. Anything below average. So that could be everything from the worst movie we've ever seen to, not very good. And then, of course, C+ is above average. And that is everything from, we just kind of recommend this one, we hope you see it, to literally the greatest movie ever made. Those are all covered under the C+ banner. On that note, where does the Fallout rate?
A C+.
Okay.
I think this is a pretty good one. I think Jenny Ortega is really, really good.
Cool.
I think the whole cast is really good. And yeah, I think it's just sort of emotionally honest in a lot of ways.
All right, what about A Taste of Hunger?
A C. Okay. To repeat myself, it is emotionally frank. I think it does have a good sense of sort of panic. I don't think it's blowing the lid off of anything. It's just sort of an effective little drama.
All right. The Ice Age Adventures of Buck Wild. This is a C-. It's a dispassionate C-. Like, I'm not angry at the movie for existing the way I sometimes are for movies that really phone it in for kids. There's a certain extra laziness I find when, like, you phone it in for kids that kind of pisses me off. This is just cheap, kind of thrown together, but relatively harmless. It's just not very good. Then we got, let's see, what was on the thing? The House.
I like The House. Yeah. I mean, I'm just a sucker for stop motion, so I'm going to give it a C+. Nice. It's on Netflix. It's got a, I didn't mention it does have like an all-star cast. It's got like, you know, Miranda Richardson is in it, and Matthew Good is in it, and some other recognizable British actors.
All right. Home Team, starring Kevin James, is another dispassionate C-. It's just, okay, it just never figures out how to tell this damn story. Like, are you doing the funny Happy Madison version of it sometimes? Are you doing the actually kind of serious melodramatic coming of age story about a kid, you know, reuniting with his father over football sometimes? And neither one's ever convincing because the comedy undermines the drama and the drama undermines the comedy. So it just never quite works. There's a story in here somewhere. I'm not sure where, but I'm sure they could have found it if they picked a lane. And then what do we got here? A Hero.
A C+. Mm-hmm. I really liked A Hero. It's one of those panic attack movies.
It's so damn harrowing.
You're freaking out at every bad decision this guy makes, but yet you understand every bad decision he makes.
It's not as apocalyptically panic ridden as, say, Uncut Gems or anything like that, where everyone's going to die. But there's something even more relatable about it because it's just, man, nothing's gonna go right, is it?
Yeah.
And I don't even get the right to be mad because everyone's got a fucking point. I hate that, but it's also so real. So yeah, I give it a C+ as well. It's an excellent motion picture. And then I'm curious, we finally landed on New York Ninja.
I give it a C. Okay. I feel like it's lacking that sort of crazy edge.
Yeah.
All of, like, the craziest part of it is, I think, added by the people who are putting it together after the fact, rather than springing organically from sort of the weird film that this guy made back in 1984. But it is just fascinating to see it finally come together. And I think it's more interesting when you know the story than it would be if you were just sort of finding this in a video store somewhere.
This should have like an introduction with it. Like someone just explaining like just how neat this is. And you can watch special features, you'll get there, but that should probably be part of the program. Mm-hmm. I agree. It's an interesting archival project. I'm glad it exists and I had fun watching it. It's not so amazing that like you need to see this damn thing now. But it's definitely a C for novelty value and a couple of fun action bits. If this sounds like the kind of thing you'd be excited about, like, again, if you own a copy of Gymkata, this gets elevated specifically for you to a C+. Mm. Like, this is specifically made for you if you own Tiger Claws. Like, that's where the line is. But if you don't, it's a C. It's of interest. Check it out if you can. But, I digress. Mm. Anyway, that's it for this week on Critically Acclaimed. We'll be back next week with reviews of Moonfall.
Yay!
I'm weirdly looking forward to Moonfall. Like, it looks so stupid. I'm just like, be as stupid as you can. I dare you. Roland, I gave Geostorm a positive review. I'm an easy mark.
Roland Emmerich, he can do it. He can
he
make.
Can do it. He doesn't always.
An excellent piece of cheese.
Sometimes he makes a crappy piece of cheese, but when he's working and he's firing on all cylinders,
he is a prime cheese maker. And let's hope that this one.
Yeah, it's been a while.
More White House down and less 2012.
Based on the trailer, it's been a while since we've had a movie that looks unapologetically dumb with this budget. So hopefully it works out. But in any case, we got that coming up. We got the American release of The Worst Person in the World. We'll be talking about
that. It's an Oscar contender.
Yep.
Oscar,
and hopeful.
What a submission.
It's Oscar a submission. It could be nominated for Best Foreign Language Film, and it might be nominated for some other things. It's got like a lot of traction in like Best Actress and a few other categories. So we got that and probably a few other things besides. So thank you everybody for listening. If you want to talk to us, boy, are you in for a treat. Because you can email us. And we can read your email on an upcoming episode of our podcast, We've Got Mail, right here at the Critically Acclaimed Network. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Whitney, if people prefer to write a letter, Sometimes people send us things too. What's the address to do that?
Panos in Epistolary. Send it to the critically acclaimed network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
And of course, we're on Twitter at Critic Acclaim. I'm at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibold.
I also have a soap store with my partner, M. Lampas da Silva. It's called Salt Cat Soap. It's on social media, Twitter and Instagram, at Salt Cat Soap. It's an Etsy store. We make handcrafted soaps, and we've got some really cool designs out for Valentine's Day. So if you're thinking of fun gifts to get people for Valentine's Day, something that smells really, really sweet, we've got some gift sets of soap hearts that smell very flowery. Some smell very chocolatey. The apartment smells delightful right now, I assure you.
Data, what is this? It's a human heart. Yes, sir, but it is dipped in chocolate.
Ooh. But anyways, we got some really nice gift sets out there, so we hope you enjoy them. We hope you consider them for your Valentine's Day needs. And that's it. Oh, don't forget, if you want to get even more exclusive shows, head on over to our Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. We're reviewing every single episode of Star Trek in order, every single episode of the 1960s Batman, every single movie ever nominated for Best Picture. We just did a commentary track for one of our favorite comedies, Brain Donors. We do hangouts with our patrons every month. A lot going on over there. patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. Very special thank you to all of our patrons, without whom our show could not exist. And on that note, never forget, everyone's a critic, is how we end the podcast usually. And this time, we're going to do it the same way. So never forget, everyone's a critic, again.
I want to go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?